Hello and welcome to this week's instalment of Nucleus Investment Insights. And today we're going to be looking at some recent Australian jobs data. So we thought we'd entitle today's presentation, Is Australia's Jobs Miracle on Borrowed Time? I'm joined today by our Chief Economist, Leith Van Onselen. G'day, Leith.
G'day, Tim. G'day, everyone.
And our Head of Investments, Damien Klassen. G'day, Damien.
Hi, Tim.
Welcome, fellas. So the agenda for today is we're going to start by looking at the changing nature of Australia's jobs market. We're then going to be looking into recent jobs boom, some data into that, then peeling back some growth prospects for the jobs and the direction of jobs and the heading in Australian, or the way that it's shaping out in the Australian economy. Moving across then into whether or not the Australia's jobs market is sustainable, and then finishing up, as always, looking at the investment outlook and how we use these themes every day in the portfolios at Nucleus Wealth and the MB Fund. So with no further ado, Damon?
I just want to preface as well by saying we've had this view, and we published something a couple of weeks ago about it, just talking about how a lot of the Australian economy is really dependent upon what's happening in the jobs market at this point. It's sort of this quite fragile state where, to put it into context, we saw from 2012 to 2017 this big housing boom in most of Australia as credit conditions were loosened up. We saw influxes of foreign buyers. We had a very favourable tax situation. Everything was all pointing in the same direction. And we had lending that later was deemed to be irresponsible lending by the Royal Commission. So it's almost a perfect stage for housing growth. The thing was, in Perth, house prices fell over that time period. And the reason why was because the jobs market had turned and that you're seeing increased unemployment in that. And it wasn't even particularly high unemployment. Like, it was just more, came off a very low base and jumped up to a sort of a more moderate level. And so what we're really looking at in the Australian economy at the moment is, if jobs don't hold up, then it doesn't matter how much is being thrown at the housing market in terms of, yes, take 95%, borrow 95% of your house, free up all the, let's go back to irresponsible lending, telling the banks, all these things that the government's trying to do to really try and push the house prices up, and RBA rate cuts. Because in the end, if the RBA cuts its rates, but you haven't got a job, you can't afford your house. Mm. If you can borrow 95%, up to 95% to buy a new house, but you haven't got a job, you're not buying a new house. And so that's where our key focus really is on this jobs market. And that's why we wanted to focus on today on what's going on at the coalface, because we're just in this initial stage of seeing the downturns. And if we're relatively sanguine about it, we sort of figure that maybe we can see house prices go sideways for a while and possibly rise a little bit on the back of this on the back of sort of all the things that the government's throwing at it. Mm-hmm. But if the jobs doesn't hold up, and it's particularly construction jobs, then that's where the whole thing could come unraveled. And that's why we wanted to really focus in and get Leith in today to go through some of the latest stuff we've seen on the jobs market.
Okay, sure. Fantastic. So we'll kick off with a quick run through. So we've got a chart up here kicking off at in the 2000s and through to now, essentially. Showing a reasonably tumultuous annual change in jobs, but we're sort of looking at a reasonably high mark at the moment, although it's cooled off a little bit since 2017, Leith.
Yeah, so this is just basically a state of play. So we've had this 2 years of incredibly strong jobs growth where Australia's been adding more than 300,000 jobs per annum over the past 2 years. Right. And as Tim mentioned, it's just starting to tail off now, but it has been an exceptionally strong period. So this is just kind of, setting the scene for where we are at the moment. But if you go to the next slide, just want to point out that the unemployment rate has fallen over recent years, down, it fell to almost 5% at one point, but that's started to tick up. But the biggest story here is that underemployment, which is basically people who can't get enough hours, they want to work more, etc., has actually been at quite high levels. It's almost 9%, and whereas labour underutilisation, which is basically unemployment and underemployment combined, is running at near 14%. So that's both those have been at very high levels, and that explains why the economy's got all this surplus capacity and why we can't effectively get wage growth.
Mm.
And some of this probably the rise of the WeWork was last week's complaint, the rise of the Ubers and the gig economy.
Yeah, that's right.
Which sort of allows people who have lost their jobs to still keep at least a couple of hours a week in terms of the work, but they don't want to be a full-time Uber driver or Deliveroo or whatever. So a lot of that is coming back to that underemployment is, as you said, becoming a better measure. And there's been a number of things right across the world in terms of saying the same thing, that underemployment is now the key factor you really need to focus on, because it doesn't matter that you had jobs falling that whole time. So we saw, where are we from 6.5% unemployment to 5%? Mm. And meanwhile, wage growth was about as weak as it's been ever.
Yeah.
Over that time frame. And that's because you can see that underemployment rate was rising over that period.
Mm.
So, so that's one side. But the other thing that's interesting is we've got this little hook on the end of that where, we've risen from 5.2 or 5.3 or something at the
5.3,
moment.
5.3, yeah.
Yeah.
This is the unemployment
rate. The unemployment rate, yep. Yeah. So unemployment rate's ticked up for the last little while, but there's still incredibly strong jobs growth because there's so many people coming into Australia.
That's right.
That that you got to find, if you're not finding a couple hundred thousand jobs a year, then you're going backwards.
Then you've got unemployment.
So the net overseas migration currently is at 250,000, which is incredibly high historically.
Yep.
And obviously a high proportion of those migrants are of working age, mm-hmm. so they add directly to the labour force as they come in.
Yep.
So that's one of the reasons why we're not creating enough jobs to get the excess labour supply down. On top of that, the RBA has also pointed out that the participation rate from older Australians, so those over 65, has increased.
Yep.
That's at the margin sort of thing. But in the year 2000, 7% of people who were aged over 65 were in the labour force. Now it's about 14%. So that's doubled over almost 20 years. So that's also adding to labour supply as well.
Okay.
Although not nearly as much as migration, which RBA doesn't like to talk about.
Yeah. But I'd treat the increased aging as generally a good thing, as long as it's
voluntary. They want to do it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
As long as it's like no, I have to go out and work because I can't possibly afford to retire. But I think in general, it is a positive thing for the economy that you've got those, because regardless, those people are going to be in Australia, and so you're either paying for their retirement or they're out there paying for their own. Well, sorry, you're either paying for them to live from. To keep working from 60 to 65, or you're paying for their retirement.
Yeah, and a lot of people, we've got longer life expectancies now, so there's no need, especially if you're in a professional job, to necessarily retire at 65 if you want to keep working.
Yep.
Classic examples, Robert Gottliebson at the Australian. I don't like what he writes, but to his credit, he's about 70, I think, and he's still going. And
plugging away.
Yeah, and he often mentions that he does it by choice. He doesn't have to. He wants to keep active and keep his brain going, etc. That's great.
So do you think they're asking him to work, or he's just offering to work?
So you want more articles from Robert?
No. I'm not saying that. But as a in principle, like, these people working long is good. And in fact, Australian policy is geared towards that. We've got the pension age will rise to 67 in the next sort of 5-6 years. So that's trying to encourage people to stay longer. There's been talk to increase it to 70 eventually.
Yep.
Policies. This is all part of Ken Henry's 3 P's. Population, which we don't want, productivity, anticipation. Those two are the keys, particularly productivity, if you want to raise living standards in the long run.
Okay, sure. Yep. Just quickly, for those listening on the podcast, I didn't mention before, but the chart's available in a link in the show notes. And for those that are listening in live, please pop in your questions in the box underneath today as well. Just a quick one, just while we're on this slide here, for those that are following, a little bit of background behind the unemployment rate and the underemployment rate. They're obviously, they're numbers on the screen, or they're lines on the screen, but what actually denotes what an unemployment sort of figure is? Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah. So basically, the ABS defines it as someone who's actively seeking work and is working for more than, someone who's actively seeking work is unemployed, but you're employed if you work more than 1 hour a week.
Okay. Yeah, right. Stringent.
Whereas underemployment is if you want more hours.
Okay.
Effectively, yep. Underutilization is just the sum of those.
Yep. Okay. Yeah. Sure.
So, and that's what I'm saying about the gig economy. It's now very easy for people to get gig economy jobs.
for two hours a week, and then
Airtasker, you know, Uber, etc.
Yep. Yep. Okay. Sure thing. All right. We'll jump across to the next one. So, where exactly have these jobs come from?
Yeah. So I just wanted to put a quick summary by industry about how the Australian job market has changed since the financial crisis hit in almost 2008. Now, it's a bit of an arbitrary time period, but I started tracking this years ago from the GFC just to see how we're going, just because it seemed like a good starting point. And effectively, the lion's share of Australia's jobs growth has actually come out of healthcare and social assistance. So we've added about 620,000-odd jobs since then, which is which dwarfs the rest. Like, the next highest is professional and scientific services. That's like, you know, people working in accounting, engineering, management consultants or consultants, etc.
Yeah,
basic professional services. That added 385,000. So, healthcare and social assistance is dominated, and that partly reflects, to a great extent, reflects the aging of the population. Mm. So, as the population ages, you expect more people to work in aged care, health, etc. Yep. It also is influenced by government type programs. So, mm-hmm. for example, we've had the rollout of the NDIS, which has driven growth in the last few years, massive amount of healthcare and social services jobs.
And from what I've seen as well, I don't know exactly how they're classified, but there is a whole army of middlemen who've sprung up around the NDIS,
yep.
and or middle people. I suspect a lot of those are ending up in professional, scientific, and technical services.
I imagine so. The healthcare and social system would be if you're directly in those industries.
Yep.
Whereas you got the hangers-on, which would be the consultants and stuff.
Yep. The facilitators.
Facilitators.
So to put it in context, basically the NDIS works as there's a pot of money which people are allowed to have, and then there's the person who gets it on the end, and quite often. I think most people get it through an intermediary, so it does all the paperwork for them, and then says, "Here's your." Yeah, here's your money
fee.
To go out and do it for a fee.
Yep.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay, sure. All right, very good. We'll jump across now
I just want to add at the same time, I forgot to mention it. So while those jobs have boomed, manufacturing's retrenched. Mm. So we've lost about 170,000 jobs since the GFC in manufacturing. So manufacturing's been absolutely spanked, and that comes down to the high Australian dollar, obviously,
yep.
and the closure of the car industry, etc.
Yep. Okay. Sure thing. We've then got a look at the similar breakdown, but now over the last quarter.
No, last year.
Last year.
Yeah. I was going to put the last quarter in, but I just put the last year to simplify it a bit because it's a bit choppy quarter by quarter.
Okay.
So basically, over the past year, we've had this professional services, education, administration are the three main drivers of jobs growth, and again, manufacturing's retrenched. That's lost about 77,000. So. It again comes down to this whole NDIS thing. Also, education jobs have been booming because of the rise in overseas students. Last 6-7 years since the Gillard government, we also had a massive ramp up in domestic students at university as well because of the demand-led
vet school system.
Vet, but also demand-driven university as well. Basically, they uncapped university places. So what that meant was pretty much anyone who wants to study can study now. So we've got this oversupply of people studying uni. Good policy, that. But that has driven a big rise in education over the past year, but also since the GFC, we've added about 270,000 jobs, and so third biggest job creator.
Mm.
You
can see here the second largest detractor, I guess, but by some margin, less than manufacturing, is information and telecommunications, which is interesting given that we're sort of going through a bit of a boon in the NBN. Yeah. So with that, is that predicted to increase, I guess, as the NBN rolls off in the next couple of years, would you say?
Yeah, I'd say so for sure. Yeah. The NBN is supposed to be finished in the next year or so. It's supposed to be about now, but it's delayed as always.
Yep.
So you'd expect that to lose a few jobs as well.
Okay.
So, So I guess the next few charts, we're going to look at a couple of the main industries and some of the key industries that are going to face pretty stiff headwinds.
Okay, sure. Yeah. So we'll jump across to job outlook.
Now, I'll just let you know, I've left the biggest one for last.
All right.
So we'll talk about that one last, which Damien, if you listen to Damo earlier, you've got a pretty good idea which one that is. But first of all, I thought we'd start off with healthcare and social services because that's, again, been the by by far the biggest jobs driver since the GFC. And also the biggest employer in Australia. It accounts for about 13% of total jobs. And it's had, you know, as I said, massive growth. Well, unfortunately for healthcare, while structurally it's in a good position because we're going to have a ever-aging population, which is going to need more healthcare and, you know, aged care, et cetera.
Surely we could ramp up immigration a bit more, Leith. You'd be on board with that.
Yeah, potentially. But I guess it's my point, in the immediate term, next few years, it's going to face the jobs growth should at least tail off, if not fall, because of the rollout of the NDIS. So basically, NDIS is supposed to be $22 billion a year spending on it, and it's been getting rolled out progressively through Australia over the past several years. And that rollout is meant to finish this year. So it doesn't mean that the spending is going to stop. It just means that it'll hit...
The growth stops.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, the growth stops, so it'll stop adding to jobs.
Yep, okay.
So we're expecting healthcare and social services to sort of hit a brick wall in terms of jobs growth.
All right, yep.
Next couple of years.
And potentially as well, you might see a bit of the... Because of what I was speaking about with all the middlemen, at some stage, maybe we're 2 or 3 years away from it still, but at some stage there'll be a refocus on, just a minute, where do these middlemen come from? How come we're paying all these extra people? We need to clean out and refocus and actually get the money going back, you know, get as much money possible going to the people who need it as opposed to middle people.
Yep.
And so who knows how far that away is, but I'd say sometime in the next 5 years, you will see a crackdown and a real refocus, which will probably take a bit of jobs out of this.
Royal Commission, perhaps.
Who knows? Seems to be, not the last one seemed to do much. You know, we'll see whether...
that's true.
They're losing their sting.
Very good. And I guess another component of this as well is that Australia does have a, comparatively to a lot of other places in the world, a very high standard of living and vis-a-vis healthcare as well. So, you'd expect... You know, this sort of growth to go. But as you say, there's some headwinds coming once the NDIS stops vacuuming up all the healthcare sort of requirements.
That's right. So this sort of short-term boom we've had in jobs, which is really, NDIS has been one of the main drivers of Australia's total massive jobs growth the last few years.
Yep.
That's going to at least, it's going to stop growing.
Yep.
Which means, and as we know, with growth economics, you got to always keep growing. So, you know, if it stops growing, it just means jobs growth tends.
Got to juice that GDP, Leith.
That's right. Yeah.
Well, we'll roll across to education.
Yeah. So education, again, this has been the third biggest job driver since the GFC. Again, it comes down to the demand-driven university program, which has basically been axed.
Yep.
So that massively ramped up domestic university enrollments. And that's now tailed off. But on top of that, the international student trade is now hitting its limits.
Right.
So we've effectively, China's enrollments from China are just starting to fall.
Okay.
Visa applications from China have already fallen for basically the last year, which is a leading indicator for enrollments. And China's our biggest international student export market.
Okay.
Also, the second and third biggest markets, India and Nepal, have now been labelled high risk by the Australian government. And what that means is that now visa applications are a lot more difficult for those two nations. They're going to have to basically have bona fide proof that they've got strong English language proficiency. They're going to have bona fide proof they've got enough money to fund their studies rather than coming here to work, et cetera, and in Mickey Mouse courses.
Yep.
So that's going to spank our second and third biggest source nations for international students. So the upshot here is that the international student trade's probably already peaked, if not as close to peaking, and numbers should fall going forward, which will obviously impact the education jobs. Now, education accounts for about 8% of total jobs in Australia.
Yeah, so, that's huge.
So it should subtract going forward.
Okay, sure thing. Looking across now to retail.
Yeah, now retail's hasn't been a hugely growing employment sector over recent years. It's grown, you know, I guess in line with the economy, but it does account for 10% of jobs, 9.9% of jobs. And expecting that to tread water or maybe fade a bit because consumption spending's been tanking and retail sales have been tanking across the economy.
Yeah, and it is interesting where, and for those watching in on the show, the, what was it, around sort of 2003, 2004, it appears that as a percentage of the workforce sort of peaked out there and it's sort of been just drifting down slowly. And we obviously expect that to continue. Probably coincides nicely with the likes of online shopping starting to hit its hit its straps.
And also just the growth in the other areas like healthcare. So obviously that means retail share falls. So the absolute numbers employed in retail has been rising, but the share of the economy has been falling for a number of years. And I expect that, that'll continue with, for you know, online shopping, stretched consumers, high household debt.
And growth of other industries.
So, not expecting too much joy there.
Well, and there's lots of different self-help. You know, there's most people would be well aware of going through the checkouts by themselves now, and there's a bunch of,
I forgot about that.
Amazon and a whole bunch of
others. I was wondering where you're going with self-help then. Was that retail therapy or something?
No, but there's also lots of other, Amazon's testing, the stores with where you basically the cameras track you the whole way through and they work out what you've got and then charge it to your card. And you just walk in, pick up stuff and walk out. And so there will be technological changes that sort of push towards, I don't think they'll be over zero, but we'll be pushing, certainly trying to limit the number of staff.
Yep.
Yeah, and I must admit, I used to work at Target for 4 years at university, and back then there was tons of staff employed, registers on the floor, etc. You step into a Target nowadays, you're lucky to find anyone.
It's like an Aldi.
Yeah, that's it. It is. It's almost like an Aldi.
Very good. Okay, we'll move into, I think, the big topic of the day, construction.
Yeah, now this is the big kahuna. In terms of the jobs outlook, it's not now. Construction accounts for 9.1% of Australia's total jobs, so it's not the biggest employer. That goes to healthcare and social services, and retail is even a bit more. But it's also incredibly volatile, and it's probably the big swing factor in the couple of years ahead.
Yep.
So there's currently 1.2 million Australians employed in construction, and the numbers have absolutely boomed since the early 2000s, as has the share. Across the economy, and that's got to do with the big infrastructure build out, the massive housing construction boom, obviously all the mining boom as well we had through that period,
but also the large amount of immigration. So if you're going to run a high immigration, you need to have more of your population employed in construction in order to build places for those people to live.
Yeah,
so,
great point.
Absolutely. So it's driven massively, but there's some massive headwinds coming in the period ahead. The biggest one of those, if you skip to the next one, is the dwelling construction. Now, the ABS released the June quarter commencements and completions data for dwellings, and that actually showed a tiny little uptick in the June quarter. But and that actually explains why over the last year we've actually added construction jobs, and it's actually hit an all-time high. But the problem is, when you look ahead, the biggest indicator is actually dwelling approvals. Anyone who's watching live can see the lag, or can see the correlation between approvals and commencements, and then also the lag with completions. So effectively, when actual dwelling construction follows approvals, and approvals have crashed at one third since the 2015 peak, and it's a very nasty trend line there. And what this means is that given the delay, most of our dwellings now, the lion's share actually apartments now.
Okay.
And especially in the high-rise space, it's usually about a two-year lag between an approval for an apartment and then actually construction.
Finished. Yep, okay.
And on top of that, we've got all these the concerns around...
building quality.
Yeah, building quality, flammable cladding, all this sort of stuff. So demands for apartments is probably likely to fall even further. So this one-third decline in dwelling approvals is pointing to some pretty heavy construction job losses. Now, I haven't put this chart in there. We used it last week, but the other flip side to dwelling construction, and it's not nearly as employment intensive, is infrastructure. Now, according to the forecasts from Deloitte, ANZ, etc., we're actually at peak infrastructure spend as well.
Right.
So this doesn't mean that as things like the NBN roll off.
A local peak in terms of saying it'll be higher in 5 years' time.
Yeah, yeah.
But over the next year or two, we're at a peak for the next year or two, just given the projects that are currently planned and have run over.
That's right. And it doesn't mean we're still going to have a lot of construction. But again, this gets down to this growth thing. In order to have jobs growth, you've got to build more this year than you did last year.
Yep.
So it doesn't matter if this year we build more than we did 2 years ago. We might still remain at near a record high, but if it's not as bigger than last year, you still lose jobs.
Then you're flat. Yeah, okay. Yeah.
So that's kind of the situation we're at. We've got this massive decline in dwelling construction about to hit us, or it's probably happening right now. And we're not going to have the offset from infrastructure, which is sort of going to also trend a bit lower as the NBN rolls out, because that's also nearing its end as well in build. If you skip along to the next one, we've got this great chart from that UBS has put together, which uses Seek and ABS data, etc. And it shows that construction job ads have already fallen by 30%. And what they've done is they've shown the correlation between that and actual construction employment. And they've shown that there's a very, very strong correlation, as you'd expect, between job ads and employment. And so, obviously, a 30% decline in job ads is pointing to some pretty hefty job losses for the construction industry.
But this chart as well is where you can see that final endpoint, excuse me, where for the construction employment, where there's been a tick up in that for the last couple of months, and which is sort of anomalous. And that's where I'm saying this is where we're pretty focused on trying to work out, you know, is this real? Is there something? Is there something we're missing completely? But at the moment, because all the leading indicators look like they're headed, you know, that you're going to lose, 20% say of the construction sector is going to lose their jobs, which and what the flow on effects could be, and whether that what that means for the rest of the Australian economy. At the moment, that hasn't happened.
No.
So
almost at a high point.
Yeah, everything looks all the forward stuff looks pretty dire. Current positions are pretty good.
Yep.
Yeah. And but, so that's where we really are focused, and so we really haven't seen any signs as yet.
No, and in fact the latest employment data by industry, so this was up to August actually, again show that construction jobs hit an all-time high.
Wow. Yep.
So it's kind of the calm before the storm.
Yep.
And I think this gets down to the fact that all these this huge pipeline of apartment construction is that we've had over several years has just been completed.
Yep.
So there's been this sort of, you know, they're finishing off projects.
Mm.
But the forward outlook based on dwelling approvals is terrible.
Yeah, right. Yep,
so,
yep.
You know, it's great. They're working on finishing off projects now, but then what?
What's the next gig?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. Yeah.
And these aren't the types of things where, you know, let's say the government recognises this problem and decides it's going to step in and let developers borrow up to 95% of the value of their project or whatever it wants to do to try and get things going again.
Mm.
There's a decent lag. You know, if they started that tomorrow, you've got a
couple of years before the shovel goes in the dirt.
At least a year. Yeah.
Probably a year till it starts, and then 2 years before they're sort of finished.
Yep.
So,
yeah. But there's an air pocket we're looking at the moment.
And that's the thing to bear in mind here. We're sort of looking, you know, 12 to 18 months ahead here.
Yeah.
Or maybe 2 years max. Like beyond that, there's too much uncertainty.
Mm.
So, you know.
Interesting. Okay. All right. Very good. So, I guess drawing all that in together, the economic outlook's not looking too fantastic.
Yeah. So, I just thought I put one chart in, but I could have really used about 10, to be honest with you. I just used one summary chart. So, we've had all these indicators come out the last couple of days with the NAB business survey. We've had the Westpac Consumer Sentiment Index, Confidence Index, whatever you want to call it. Credit Suisse has this fantastic proprietary activity tracker, which correlates incredibly strongly with domestic demand. So that's basically domestic growth when you leave out exports and stuff. And they've all absolutely crashed. So basically, consumer confidence yesterday fell to the lowest level in 5 years. We got the NAB business survey shows domestic demand, CapEx, construction all absolutely plummeting to almost recessionary levels, and whereas Credit Suisse's proprietary tractors hit the lowest level since the 1990s recession.
Wow!
And anyone who's watched this live can see the correlation between that and an actual domestic final demand.
It's very strong, isn't it? Yeah, it's a terrific.
Yeah. So we've got this corker of a situation where the economy is looking incredibly sick, and at the same time we've got a government. The coalition who's wedded to this surplus and doesn't seem prepared to step up stimulus, which is what we really need, and based on ideology, really. It's not in its belief system, and it basically is trying to, I guess, juice the housing market, trying to force the RBA to cut interest rates in the hope that households borrow leads to more consumption spending, suddenly leads to a new dwelling construction boom, and then hoping, I guess, the commodity price boom that we've had because of the flood in Brazil, etc., somehow reasserts itself.
Yep.
So it's really sort of a hope strategy, which isn't going to work. So that in itself is pointing to some pretty heavy job losses.
It might work. Just it doesn't seem like a high probability.
That's right. Yeah. Look, I mean, Australia's it's worked so many times before. Australia's just, you know,
got lucky.
Yeah, that's it. Last year was a classic. You know, Brazil had a flood that.
Dam collapse.
Sorry. Dam collapse, which took out, you know, the Brazil's a large chunk of its iron ore trade, which led to Australia's iron ore prices going through the roof and all this budget windfall and whatever. That was just pure luck.
Bit of a Stephen Bradbury, really.
That's it. Yeah, Stephen Bradbury. So we're sort of hoping this happens again. It's happened so many times that the government, I think, is hoping it happens again rather than trying to be proactive.
Yep.
And, you know, the upshot is that the employment market is looking very dire, and that's, you know, obviously most most obvious through the whole construction side. But there's also more broadly through the consumer economy and et cetera, et cetera.
Yes. Well, not fantastic. So I guess given those themes, Damien, how are we translating this into our thinking in our portfolios at Nuclear as well?
Yeah, so I'll come back to a podcast we did a few weeks ago as well. So there's a couple of different elements we can look at. So our main assets that we try and look to invest in are the core sort of safe assets, safe liquid assets that sort of sit around. It's where sort of the word nucleus comes from. Is we're looking for those assets bonds, and when I say bonds, I'm talking Aussie government bonds. About federal bonds. I'm not talking about emerging market debt or company bonds. We're talking about the safest ones we can find. We're talking about cash. We're talking about blue chip international equities and Aussie equities.
Sure.
And so they're the sort of four main things we can play with in terms of where we're trying to allocate our money. Now, for a while, we've been saying the Australian market is not the place to be, and it's expensive. The growth is low, and we're seeing more and more of that come about. And that's what we're really looking at here, is saying, is there on the housing and employment front, are there any signs that we've got it wrong? And so at the moment, you know, the current signs on the employment side is saying, well, yeah, the actual current figures look like we've got it wrong, or the future figures look like we've got it right. If something dissociates and all of a sudden we will get it wrong, but we think we're on the right path on that front, despite the fact we really haven't seen those signs as yet.
Yep.
But we do think that's still coming. All the forward indicators are still showing what we're expecting.
Yep.
Then we've got international. And so we're called the four horsemen of the apocalypse. And these are sort of four events that could throw the international economy off kilter and send it into recession.
Downside risks of
Yep. And so, so there's the Brexit and whether that causes issues. There's obviously a trade war and increasingly heated in recent days. Between US and China, but they are negotiating at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
There's Hong Kong issues, which again look to be getting worse, not better. And finally, oil and a bunch of things around the oil price and the effects on CapEx and spending.
Okay.
So we've got these. None of those are looking particularly great. So they're your downside potential risk cases.
These are what would you typically term as being an external shock, I guess, essentially, that could upset our bubble at the moment.
Yeah. And so if you manage to sail through all of those and none of those set off any alarms and keep the world economy going, and then the Australian housing reverses or at least all those forward indicators are shown to be completely wrong and it actually does come good and everything skates along, then we're going to have everything. We're going to have our asset allocation wrong, and you know, you should be piling into all the equities.
Yep, sure.
We don't think that's the case. Mm. We think that the housing has got downside, and then on top of that, you've got the downside from any one of these other four horsemen potentially coming through
and exacerbating. Yep.
And so we're very much looking for safety. The bond market agrees with us, and that's been a great source of profits for us.
Mm.
But bonds are getting so expensive now; it's very hard to keep playing that game.
Yep.
So loading up on cash and international equities and some international currency, because that's where we think the real benefits are at the moment for people in their superannuation funds or investment funds.
Okay, sure. Fantastic. Just a quick question here from a listener. So a couple here, actually. Is Nucleus likely to go long and short at any point in the next few years? A little bit of...
No.
Around there?
No. We're not... we're not looking at the. I guess we've tried to line our portfolios up very much those low risk, safe, steady, the boring parts of the portfolio that should make up the bulk of it. Long short strategies and playing around on options markets and whatever you want. Certainly there's scoped for people to do those and to make money from it. We see that as a satellite to your portfolio, and whereas we operate sort of in that core part of the portfolio.
So essentially giving people the ability to leave their money with the boring stuff with us, and if they know what they're doing in those more exciting parts of the world, then they can dabble and concentrate on that.
Absolutely. But if it blows up, you've still got the core money.
Exactly.
Left behind.
One other one. So what do you guys make about the international investor leaving Aussie banks alone story?
Yeah. Look, they call this the widowmaker, the trade. Well, there's a lot of trades people call the widowmaker, but one of them is Aussie banks for the last, I'd say about 5 years, maybe a little bit longer. There's been a lot of discussion about how do you play the falling apart of China. If you have the view that China's got a debt problem and that at some stage that debt problem will come unwound, how do you play that from an investment perspective? And a big favorite is shorting the Aussie banks.
Yep.
The problem with that is the Aussie banks pay such a high dividend yield, and we put together our, as we said, irresponsible lending laws for 4 or 5 years, which meant that all these people investing on the fall of China then meant that they actually lost a lot of money on that.
Yep.
As Aussie banks sort of boomed away.
Because if you're short a stock, then you've got to cover the dividend as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. So it's very costly on that. But the shares went up as well as we put on this huge housing boom and lent irresponsibly.
So it really went the other way.
So it did really go the other way. And now we're at this point where foreign investors look at what's happened in every other market around the world and suffering low interest rates. So the benefit in Australia was we managed to keep our interest rates a lot higher than the rest of the world.
Mm.
And banks generally do well when the yield curve has got some steepness to it. So they get to borrow at short-term rates pay very much in interest, and then they get to lend it out at higher rates.
Bigger margins.
On longer periods, yeah. Yep. And so when they flatten out, banks start to you start to see those converge and especially get close to zero, then you start losing bank profitability.
Okay.
And that's a lot of the problem they're facing in Europe is they've got all these banks that were never properly capitalized anyway following the financial crisis, and they're stuck with interest rates that are zero or negative. And so they've got their banking system on life support already. And it's just not profitable because of the way they've done their interest rates. But they've got to keep their interest rates low because otherwise they'll ruin the rest of the economy.
That's right. Yep.
So you're stuck in this quandary. And so and as Australian bond rates have come rocketing down as well, and international investors are saying, well, Australia is not so different to the rest of the world. What's happened elsewhere will happen in Australia. And Aussie banks have done a great job in earning, keeping their margins really high while they're lending irresponsibly in the Australian economy.
Mm.
As that comes to an end, then look out for the Australian banks.
So do you feel that the Aussie bank sort of theme now, although it's probably been translated to be a number of years between, say, what's been happening in the European side, do you think we're now just starting to sit in that same category? To put it another way, is the widowmaker trade going to remarry?
I think there's a lot of people now, and as you said, that the trade we've seen is international investors abandoning Aussie banks is what that question was about. And so there's the question is, will you see that continue? Well, you've seen it so far. Will that turn into a lot more shorts on the sector as well, and quite possibly?
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, so there's, and keep in mind, international investors don't get the benefit of the franking credits. So
right, yeah, of course,
that is a negative for them. So they're getting a much lower yield than a domestic investor.
Yeah, sure.
So okay. So I guess international investors seem to be gearing up this widowmaker trade again with a view that the time is coming.
Yep,
and that Aussie banks are going to see the shakeout. But we're pretty close to minimum weight on the Aussie banks as well ourselves, so we've got a lot of sympathy for that view.
Yep.
But again, they've got lucky a few times, and it does look like they're trying to. You've got a regulator who has been told this is irresponsible lending by a royal commission.
Yep.
And then has a prime minister and treasurer saying, "Get out and lend some more."
Yeah. Right.
So quite possibly we'll see
a bit of regulation.
Yeah. We're seeing some. We're certainly seeing a lot of forces at cross purposes in that sector.
Yep.
And again, the Aussie banks are some of the most expensive banks in the world as well.
Mm.
So with all that in place, it's saying, well, do I really want to be in one of the most expensive banks in the world with the potential for problems.
And a lot of pressure.
And our answer is no.
Yep.
There's obviously a lot of people who have answered that yes.
Yep. Okay. Fair enough. And of course, we offer the ability for clients to screen out things like Aussie banks and exposure to the Aussie housing market individually on their portfolios.
Yeah, that's right. So we find that's probably a mix of two, really. There are a bunch of people who say, well, I already own banks in my own name or in other portfolios I have.
Yep.
I don't need you to own any more of them. I've already, you know, got lots of bank exposure. And there's other people who are saying, I feel even more strongly than you about the Aussie bank situation, and I don't want to own any banks in my portfolio, or the Aussie banks.
Yep. So, yeah, sure. And just on that note as well, we've added some new ethical screens under the human rights released today, actually. Do you want to quickly run through those for those that are interested?
So there's obviously a lot of excitement about China trying to crack down on freedom of speech in other countries, and suggests that if you want to exercise your freedom of speech in America, then you won't be welcome to bring your sports or your computer software or your South Park episodes to China. We thought it was worth putting into some screens in our portfolios where people can actually look and say, well, that, you know, there is a preference for people who don't want to invest in companies that are in undemocratic or countries that don't respect human rights to the same extent as Australia or other countries.
Mm.
And so, yeah, one more screen because we like to basically we think of ethical very much as being an individual choice for people.
Yep.
And what we try to do is not force our ethical views on our portfolios. We'll put our economic views and our views about where we think valuations and the quality of stocks.
Yep.
But then we let individuals then come over the top and say, well, no, I don't want to invest in anyone that's in, you know, a non-democratic country. And maybe that's Singapore, maybe that's Hong Kong. It depends on how strict you want to be in your definition of it.
Yep.
Might be China. It gives people their own chance to put their overlays on the portfolio and actually... Yeah, yeah, take some ownership of what the ethics are and what they want to invest in.
Yeah, sure. Fantastic. And for more information about that, if you are listening in live, just head over to our blog section and you'll find some information there in much further detail. Or, of course, you can head over to portal.nucleuswealth and check out an account for yourself. Thanks very much, gentlemen. A terrific podcast today. Coming up next week, so on the 17th Thursday, the 17th of October, same bat time, same bat channel, 12:30 Australian Eastern Standard Time, we will be having a special guest. And I'm going to just leave the cloud of anonymity up there for you to come in next week and check that one out, but it's going to be well worth your time. We'll see you there. Well, that's it for now, and thanks for watching. If you like what you heard today and you'd like to hear more, head over to nucleuswealth.com/subscribe, give us your email address, and in return we'll send you a weekly email with new webinar topics, links for our podcasts, and other news from Nucleus Wealth. I certainly hope you've got something out of today, as I have, and we'll look forward to catching you at the next one. Cheers.